Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features Sudan, conflict and humanitarian crisis continue. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Wiza Muntali. The music in the background is Jabana by Nori and his Dropa Band. As we previously reported, the three-year war in Sudan between the Sudanese Armed Forces, SAF or SAF, and its former ally, the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, has caused Sudan to have the world's worst humanitarian crisis. This is currently being illustrated by the RSF's attack on Obaid, capital of North Kordofan state in Sudan. In a recent conversation with independent researcher and journalist Musa Baba in Nairobi, the show explores and contextualizes historic lack of accountability for warring parties in Sudan, the plight of children and women in the Sudan war, external and internal agents of war, and more. Here is the conversation with Musa Baba. Musa Baba, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Muiza. Really appreciate it.
Thanks. And I know it's a little bit late there in Nairobi. Just thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule and also the time difference and all that. But last time we spoke, you were on 3 months ago, actually. That was just when we were looking at 3 years of the war between the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces, which it had reached 3 years at that time. We're now in July and the war is continuing, so it's 3 years, 3 months basically. And if you could just briefly give us an update before we fully get immersed in the topic of the current situation.
Right. So in the past 3 months, there have been some developments, some of them are positive, but unfortunately, most of them have been within the war dynamics themselves. But since we last spoke, basically what happened was for the first time, there's been a breakthrough as far as the negotiations themselves, where you have now some pro-SAF political forces meeting with kind of the civilians that made up the transitional period in 2019 and agreeing on a pathway towards civilian governance and ending the war. So this is the first time that, because a lot of the political forces that were allied with SAF, there was they were pretty much against any kind of negotiations with the RSF. But there's been a direction of, European countries and kind of the U.S. on the sideline agreeing to kind of push ahead with getting political forces together, that are on the SAF side. The politicians that are on the RSF side are more kind of entrenched in this RSF coalition government, quote unquote, which is pretty much, governing most areas in Darfur and a lot of areas in South Kordofan. So basically the west of the country and the southwest of the country. But a lot of these political forces aren't really aligned with the RSF, and they're not aligned with SAF as well. So they met with the pro-SAF political groups in Berlin in April. And since then, it seems like a lot of the Western countries have put their weight behind this civilian track. Because on the other side, when you go to the countries that are controlling the more military track or providing the platform for the military track, which are basically, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Egypt, When you look at that group, you know, this is the group that are pretty much, you know, the war continuing is kind of in their favor, because the idea behind, you know, like we've discussed before, you know, the UAE and Egypt kind of being under that Western US Israel umbrella. So, but you know, going further than that, you know, the Egypt kind of controlling the east of the country and the southeast and the center of the country, while the UAE squarely controlling the west of the country and the southwest by proxy. And a, you know, anecdotal evidence of that is that about a month ago, the Egyptian Air Force came and struck inside of North Sudan, and it struck miners. Gold mines that are in northern Sudan were hit by the Egyptian Air Force, and the claim was that there's armed groups over there, and when in reality, like, these miners have been there. And the bigger issue is that there's a contested area of Halaib, which is the triangle that's in the north east of Sudan. The Egyptians claim that it's their territory, but Sudan has always maintained that these are Sudanese lands. So they hit in those lands, they hit miners in those lands and in northern state. So when you come to look at it, well, okay, so it seems like the Egyptians want to take over Sisi's government. They want to take over mining areas in northern Sudan and in southern, in like the Hadaib region. But even the gold that the Egypt exports, it goes to the UAE. And even further than that, you know, if it wasn't for the UAE, Egypt's economy would collapse completely. So this is, it's stuff like that that, you know, it brings us to a point where the war itself and the backing of the war, and from the beginning, the push towards the war, it could be seen more as an effort to divide and conquer Sudan, rather than any kind of cause, of, you know, liberating the people or, you know, bringing any kind of prosperity to them. So that unfortunately has intensified. And the dynamics, and this is the bad news, of course, you know, the dynamics on the ground, of course, you know, you have fighting in Blue Nile. So that's in the southeast of the country, and back and forth between SAF and its allied forces, and between the RSF and its allied forces. There's also a lot of skirmishes happening in northern Darfur, because those are the Darfur armed movements against the RSF. And of course, it crosses over into the border in Chad and everything. There's also some interesting developments in the southwest of the country on the border with Central African Republic. You probably know that there's been a lot of militias over there that control gold, and they're backed by some mercenaries that are left over from the Wagner days. And there's been incursions of the Seleka. You probably remember the Seleka from 2014, destabilizing the Central African Republic. They've actually crossed over into Sudan. So that's chaos that's even outside of the control of the RSF at this point. But of course, the big problem and the big issue is El Obeid. El Obeid is in North Kordofan, and it's basically been under siege since the beginning of the war. You know, back and forth, you know, the RSF takes territory, SAF takes it back. But for the past couple of months, the RSF has been determined to enter Al Ubayd. Al Ubayd has the biggest army base outside of Khartoum, and it has an airport and everything. So a lot of the airstrikes leap from there. But the entire city's been, you know, paralyzed by the RSF attacks. And of course, the drone warfare is what changed everything. You know, before, when it was just ground forces and, you know, projectiles and, not a lot of missiles and stuff like that, but just, you know, non-drone warfare, basically. But right now, the RSF has even gotten more drones. We've seen photo evidence of pretty sophisticated drone systems that they got a hold of. And they've been pummeling El Obeid, and like 500,000 people are in El Obeid. A lot of them are stuck in there. But they've basically targeted everything from food and aid convoys to electricity and the water infrastructure, sometimes attacking the markets. So it's a very dire situation, and it's reminiscent of what happened in Al-Fashir late last year,
Yeah,
when RSF went in and just massacred people. Go ahead.
thanks. Yeah, sorry, I was interjecting. Thanks again for the that update. I wanted us to get into the specifics of the what's happening in Al-Baydeed right now. And you just mentioned that if you could just tell us which what the Ubaid is the capital of North Kordofan, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and then if you could just also, before we get into sp exact specifics of what's happening there, if somebody's just looking on the map of the importance of Ubaid for all the players in this current situation, if you could give us that context as well.
Sure. So if you look at Al-Ubayd on the map, it's kind of dead smack in the middle of Sudan. So if you're going from Khartoum and you're going anywhere west in Darfur, you're going through Al-Ubayd. If you're going south towards South Kordofan and West Kordofan and these areas, you're also going through Al-Ubayd. So it's not only a trade route, but it's a huge military barracks and garrisons over there. But also, it was a huge marketplace. You know, people who bring their produce and, you know, whether it's agriculture or livestock or anything from any point west or south, Al-Ubayd was the main market for it. So it really is like, you know, a very critical vessel, critical node for Sudan when it comes to trade and people movement and stuff like that. So the RSF, what they've been trying to do, they've been trying to include North Kordofan as a state, which has its capital at Lubayd, to kind of bring it into their fold completely so that they would control all of Kordofan and all of Darfur. You know, the three states of Kordofan, north, south, and west, and the five states in Darfur, north, south, east, west, and center. So that's been kind of the RSF's goal for a long time. And Al-Ubayd is caught in the crossfire because it has a huge SAF presence, but it's been run down over time. And like I said, like when they were ground battles and using, you know, ground forces and projectiles and stuff like that, it was, you know, SAF was able to push back. But little by little, the drone warfare and targeting these pressure points within the city have just like, you know, brought life to a pretty much a standstill. And not only that, but they made it difficult for people to even leave the city. So that's been going on for a while. And basically, when you want to ask like why the RSF, you know, there's negotiations going on and all of that, because basically, with the RSF, they're looking at the Libya model. You know, they're looking at the Libya model. And if you're following Libya, you know that recently the US have been brokering a deal between the East and the West, between Benghazi and Tripoli. And basically, so it's like a power sharing deal, you know, leaving Haftar and his LNA army to control the East, while the Dibeba government control the West. So for there's probably back channels with, you know, the UAE and with Egypt and with these countries, with the US, to say that, hey, you know, this war got to a point where people in Darfur and Kordofan are not going to be able to live together with people from the center and from the east, the southeast, and the north. And it's better to just, you know, divide the country into two administrative spaces. Now, none of this has been said out loud, but the determination of the RSF is kind of an indicator as to how this can actually happen. Of course, on the other side, you have SAF like trying to just insist on its legitimacy, and it is gaining ground when it comes to its legitimacy. You know, just yesterday, or I think before, the Ugandan military officials actually went to Port Sudan, and they re-emphasized that they only recognize SAF and the central government of SAF. And this, of course, it starts to create other problems. The RSF are creating their own currency. They've created their own like infrastructure to, for example, education. They've started having students sit for the secondary certificate exam. So they want to operate as an actual government, but they're not getting any kind of recognition from anyone. Like, I don't think anyone in their right minds want to legitimize a government under the leadership of the RSF. So, but it seems like that it's a means they, to survive politically and militarily, they want to take over the entirety of Kordofan. They already control between Al-Ubayd and Khartoum. There's a town called Bara, which is also one of the, veins that go like connect the West to the center. And the RSF have taken that over, I think, since last year. So the determination for them to, and at the same time, you have other groups like the Darfur groups, armed groups that are allied with SAF. They're trying to take over areas in North Kordofan because also the defections that happened within the RSF were mostly from North Darfur. There's been defections, of course, in the past couple of months also. Some pretty high-ranking RSF commanders have defected to SAF. So, it's back and forth between SAF and the RSF. But I think both of them know that this war can't really continue. But the cover that they have from these regional countries allows them to continue, and there's no accountability, of course.
Again, that's Moussa Baba. He is an independent researcher and journalist in Nairobi. And we are looking at Sudan, the conflict and the humanitarian crisis as continuing. I wanted to expand more on the things that you raised on the strategic importance of El Baybaid. And one thing that you mentioned was the marketplace. This is also the center, one of the big centers of the Gum Arabic, right?
Yes.
As well. And if we can ex remind us what the importance of Gum Arabic as well in the Sudan's economy, beyond Sudan as well.
Right. So the Gum Arabic Belt, it goes through Kordofan and Darfur. And basically, any soft drink, hopefully nobody's buying any soft drinks because of the BDS, but if you are buying a soft drink, you're most likely drinking some of that gum arabic. So gum arabic is kind of it's a resin, but because of its texture and its preservative qualities, it's used in a lot of food manufacturing. Everything from Coca-Cola and Pepsi to sweets and candy and stuff like that is uses gum arabic. So previously, the gum arabic was kind of half nationalized, half private. But the biggest issue was always the smuggling of gum arabic. But it was such a crucial commodity worldwide that it was pretty much the only product that was excluded from the US sanctions so that it can be exported to these Coca-Cola companies and Nestle and stuff like that. Now it's a huge multi-billion dollar business. Unfortunately, right now, and especially after the war, it's almost all smuggled. Chad is now pretty much the number one exporter, but people kind of know, where the gum arabic is coming from that's exported through Chad. So that also is how the RSF funds itself. Other than the gold mining, there's also the livestock, which is kind of the number two or number three export in Sudan. But gum arabic is also big. So, it ends up with mostly like, French companies importing it. And although the gum arabic, it stretches all the way to Senegal, the concentration is in Sudan, but it crosses across the Sahel. But Sudan is kind of the number one producer. So it's been added, unfortunately, another piece to the arsenal of the RSF when it comes to resource extraction and funding themselves with this commodity. And Al-Ubayd was the main market for gum arabic. Any producer, even you had like French development companies that were actually developing gum arabic agriculture in Al-Ubayd, like head station there. So it's a critical artery for Sudan in a couple of different sectors.
And then also, sorry to interject. Also, when you said the critical artery for Sudan in different sectors, the other part is also the oil pipeline going through Obaid, right?
Yes, that's true. So the oil from the fields in especially in South Sudan and in Southwest Sudan, like West Kordofan and these areas, these pipelines go through Al-Ubayd, they go through Al-Dalany, they go through Al-Ubayd, and then to Port Sudan. But that's kind of been resolved because what happened a few months, I think it was the end of last year or so, where South Sudan actually mediated between the RSF and SAF, and basically telling them that because there was an episode last year, I don't know if you remember this, but the RSF went and took over the Higlig oil field, and the South Sudan army had to actually roll in and kind of like negotiate with the RSF and negotiate with SAF as well, because that is the only lifeline that like that's pretty much the only artery that South Sudan has for its entire economy. Its oil is pumped from South Sudan, but all of the pipelines go through Sudan and out through Port Sudan. So without that, the South Sudan government can actually collapse at any time. But that's also why you start seeing, talk about refinery projects in Kenya and in Uganda and everything, because it would also bring in a lot of income for these countries and bypass Sudan. Like it would be a hit for Sudan's economy, but the South Sudanese, from their point of view, they're like, we can't keep, trying to put out fires in Sudan just to get our oil out and export it. So yeah, Al-Ubayd is also within that, setup.
Yeah, again, that's Moussa Baba. He's the independent researcher and journalist, and we're looking at Sudan, the conflict and the humanitarian crisis that's continuing there for the last 3 years and 3 months. And again, to remind folks, when we say RSF, that's the Rapid Support Forces, and also SAF is the Sudanese Armed Forces, who have been fighting each other since April 15th. 2023, and we're unpacking the various issues of the conflict and also the humanitarian crisis. One of the things that the crisis you had mentioned about the drones, how it's impacted, especially Baida right now, which is at the center of the conflict right as we speak today in July, and the how the drones have impacted civilians, particularly children as well. A lot of children have been affected.
Yes.
And that's one thing which we throughout the this crisis, this conflict, children have been impacted, firstly with the schools. You mentioned a bit about the RSF trying to start their own education system, but also a lot of children have not been able to go to school.
Yes.
And the other aspect has been children getting killed, disproportionately high numbers, and then especially now with the drones. But the other aspect is also the child soldiers as well, the recruitment by both sides. If you could give us some context on that as well. Particularly about the child soldiers, because it reminds me of in other parts of that close to the region. Remember back in the day in Uganda with the child soldiers, and of course Sierra Leone and Liberia as well, and other wars. But how is that part of the humanitarian crisis, the impact on the society? How much is it part of that conflict on both sides, on the RSF side as well as the Sudanese Armed Forces side.
So, like, even there's been a UN report that, 330 kids have been killed this year alone. And, that's the drone warfare. You'd think that drone warfare is more precise. It's more, precise targets and stuff. But the way the RSF operates, there's no such thing as collateral damage for them. Al-Lubayd, and they've even said this, that Al-Lubayd is a fair target, without specifying and saying only military targets or anything like that. So like the children that have been caught in the crossfire is because, the entire city is pretty much targeted. This is other than areas in Darfur and in Blue Nile and these areas where the war is still going on. Even places like Adalanj are getting bombarded by drones. And you would think because, the drones that appeared in the early days of the war were more primitive drones where they would just, drop projectiles and stuff. But now you have suicide drones. Now you have, a lot more sophisticated warfare. So the children that are being, killed, that are being maimed and the injured are in also the thousands that have been injured. And it goes back to the issue where there's no accountability whatsoever. We're starting to see movements where people are referring the RSF to the ICC. There's some legal cases opened here in Kenya against the RSF and stuff like that, but it's nowhere near at the level where these forces would actually take it seriously. The bigger, not bigger, but the more, long lasting problem is going to be the issue of child soldiers. Of course, most of the recruitment of child soldiers is on the RSF side. We still haven't seen evidence of SAF using child soldiers in the battlefield, but that's been well documented on the RSF side. And to understand it, like you have to understand the makeup of the RSF. The RSF recruits tribally. So, the Himeti or Abdul Rahim would go to tribal leaders and tell them, we need your men. So naturally, like young kids who are, in their teens and stuff, who don't really have any employment prospects, are probably out of school a lot of times, for them joining up becomes part of this, mobilization for the entire tribe. So it's not divided into, okay, let's look at the graduates or the, people who've finished high, the ages that have finished high school and stuff like that. It's more kind of, general communal, mobilization, unfortunately. So that's how you get a lot of kids, in the RSF because it's a very chaotic, unorganized mechanism of recruitment and the makeup of the RSF itself. Even before the war, like the RSF would have a graduation. The graduation would be pretty much like, each tribe would do their tribal dance in like a military uniform. So, that to anybody who's a seasoned military person is just insane. But that's what we, unfortunately, what we've been dealing with. And these are the bigger dynamics and the more long-lasting dynamics that led to the war and the reason why these guys feel comfortable continuing the war. Because the question of demilitarization and, rehabilitation and stuff is stuff that's never happened, unfortunately. Since the South Sudan War, since the Darfur War, the two areas in Blue Nile and Nuba Mountains, there's never been a mechanism where you take these young people out of the militia or the military and everything and bring them, kind of, reintegrate them into civilian life, So the child soldiers that exist right now, just think about how many generations back that you have a lot of these people that have been armed and are fighting these wars. But no conversation whatsoever. The issue of security sector reform becomes just a political tool that, they put on the table, whether, it's political forces or whatever, but never. And actually, like a lot of people say that there was a framework agreement where it was tackling the big elephant in the room. This is before the war, of when will the RSF be integrated into SAF? You don't need two armies in a single country. And that's kind of one of the things when it showed that SAF and RSF have to downsize, And a lot of people are saying that's kind of one of the motivations that led them to go to war, because they don't want to, downsizing means also giving up their economic empires, especially the RSF, like the amount of companies and conglomerates that they have. It's, we're talking about billions upon billions of dollars within that economy.
You're listening to a recent conversation with independent researcher and journalist Mousab Baba, focusing on the continuous humanitarian crisis and war in Sudan. The music in the background is Darfur music. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation. Yeah, and you mentioned that this issue of child soldiers has not been addressed even after different conflicts have happened in Sudan. And the other issue has also been the violence against women as well.
Yes.
And if you can unpack that a bit more, and this ramifications on the society.
Yes. So this is also, the violence against women, the sexual violence, the conflict related sexual violence specifically has been extremely widespread, especially when you kind of see how long RSF has controlled certain areas, especially Khartoum. The line between consensual and rape disappears, and but the amount of sexual violence that has happened has been, well documented, and it's in the thousands. There's organizations like SIHA, SIHA, where they've been covering this issue from day one, and the stories are horrendous, of course. And the problem is, in our kind of communities in Sudan, it becomes a stigma going forward. So it's a stigma for the women. It's a stigma for their children if they get pregnant and give birth. And the perpetrators are, long gone after the crime is committed, so the long lasting stigma of it becomes like a huge social problem to deal with. But the biggest problem is that there's no accountability for what happened, to these women and some men, So the more there's like, hot areas of conflict or areas under control of the RSF, the people are just completely at the mercy of whoever the commander is for that period in that region.
Again, that's Mousab Baba. He's an independent researcher and journalist, and he's based in Nairobi. And we're looking at Sudan, at the conflict and the humanitarian crisis has been continuing for the last 3 years, 3 months or so. And also just looking at also future ramifications. But one of the things that we talked about earlier was the connections. There's something that we've been bringing up in our conversations. If you've been listening to our conversations with Mousab Baba in the past conversation we had a few months ago, when it was 1 year of the war, 3 years of the war, and also at other times where we looked at these external forces behind the war. But the external forces are there because of some internal dynamics. If you could unpack that as well, because it keeps coming back again and again. It's 20 years ago we were talking about Darfur. We're now here again, 2026, we're still having the issue of Darfur as well, and the conflict against people in Darfur. So what are some of the internal dynamics which have gave the external forces an avenue to be so heavily involved within Sudan's fate?
Right. So if you kind of want to summarize this war, you can call it Bashir's war. Bashir has been in power for 30 years. Both Burhan and Hemeti and their commanders and generals that are with them have been under al-Bashir for, you know, at least a decade. You know, especially in the, you know, in the RSF, you know, Bashir is the one who actually created the RSF in 2013. And brought Hemeti, being the most loyal Janjaweed guy out there, and actually put them almost at the helm of the country. That coincided also with Sudan kind of moving out of its non-aligned status and going squarely under the umbrella of the local U.S. allies. So, you know, fighting the war in Yemen on behalf of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, you know, helping Qatar and these other countries to remove Gaddafi in 2011. You know, so they had, like, Bashir's government, they had a stance where they were more non-aligned, you know, especially in the 90s and into the, but ever since the 2000s and after 9/11, they started moving and getting squeezed slowly, and they started capitulating to Western powers. And, you know, when it came to 2013, 2014, 2015, this is where they fully moved in and became almost like a vassal state of the Gulf countries. Once Bashir was removed in 2019, you know, Egypt came into the picture as well. So you had the UAE. For example, you know, Saudi Arabia seemed like to take us a couple of steps back, especially when there was a rift between Saudi Arabia and the UAE over the Yemen issue. You know, that was in pretty much the same time, around 2019. But that's basically when Bashir was removed. So the UAE went in heavily to kind of coerce the political process. And they've actually, like, coerced a lot of political actors. Unfortunately, even like Hamdok and these guys, and Egypt worked more on the SAF front to kind of inherit the Bashir regime's security apparatus, his military and his security apparatus. And the UAE was kind of more under the RSF was more under the UAE, the UAE's control. So when Bashir was removed, the Sudanese civilians looked up and they found themselves almost in a chokehold. You know, and we can't forget that this was also the Trump era. So in the Trump era, it's pretty much whatever Tel Aviv says. And for Tel Aviv, you know, they kind of dictate to Abu Dhabi and Cairo what happens with Sudan. Maybe not directly, but it's definitely in, you know, and that's basically why, you know, politically Sudan was squeezed after 2019 to sign the Abraham Accords. You know, the Abraham Accords, and Burhan actually went and pretty much agreed to sign on to the Abraham Accords. And that's one of the things that kind of, for people in Sudan, was kind of a sign that, you know, this is now becoming a fully neocolonial state. You know, you have both Burhan and Hemeti kind of racing to see who will get the best blessings of the West by, you know, appeasing Tel Aviv and Abu Dhabi and Cairo. And from there, then it became an internal competition between them. All of this while, like, the Darfur groups, for them, you know, they looked at it and they're like, okay, you know, this is going to be a difficult situation. So they signed a deal in 2020. But the deal in 2020 was just giving the Darfur liberation movement leaders power, rather than dealing with the structural issues. There's never been any accountability. You know, you have to think about it. Like, this was, By 2019, you had like almost 3 million people displaced in Darfur itself. This is other than the refugees who went to Chad, who went to South Sudan, to these areas. Nothing was done to actually right the wrongs of the Darfur genocide, for example. So this kind of created a situation where the lack of accountability became contagious. We started seeing more and more militias pop up, even militias on the SAF side. There's well-known commanders like Bouaglikekel and these guys who actually were part of SAF, and they broke out in 2020 to become their own armed movement and ask for a piece of the governing the country, and being included in the government, and basically getting a piece of the pie. So that it created an overall situation of impunity. Whatever, there's no way for you to gain your rights in Sudan unless you pick up arms. And of course, after the war actually started, that became kind of the main mode of operation for anyone in any part of Sudan who is looking at the resources leaving their state and them being in abject poverty. So, okay, the only way we can actually get our rights is if we also pick up arms. So that the dynamic of not having any kind of accountability and not fundamentally solving the problems in Darfur and in the Nuba Mountains and in Blue Nile and even in Eastern Sudan and the abject poverty that you had all across the country from this neocolonial state where all of these resources are just leaving the country and going to either private pockets or more largely into the military economy, whether it's the RSF or the many companies that are owned by SAF. So it was kind of a perfect storm that led to this war, building on the atrocities and what happened in the days like since the South Sudan, the Darfur War, and since the South Sudan War. Now we see the people who've mobilized with SAF, a lot of them are the old fighters that used to fight alongside Bashir against the South Sudanese, and bringing back kind of the same, fundamentalist, extremist, songs and even the slogans and stuff like that came back. So it's almost like if you were in Sudan in the 90s, right now it kind of looks the same, if but a lot worse now because of how more widespread the war is. Of course, back then it was a lot worse for South Sudanese, but right now it's more distributed around the country.
And it's interesting you mentioned that now Egypt has come into the mix, but Egypt has always been in the mix, in a
Yes.
sense, in Sudan, and in the particularly with the their relationship with the military, the Egyptian military and the Sudanese military have been very, very close, and that dynamic has not changed at all in a way, right? It's really been there. They've
Well,
been. It's changed in some way, but they've been a constant player.
But their role was reduced. Like, for example, in the 90s, in the 90s, the Islamist government came in very hostile towards Egypt, to the point where there was the assassination attempt on Hosni Mubarak in 1995. After that, the Egyptian military actually supported the opposition. It supported the SPLM. It supported the opposition parties that were allied with the SPLM on a military front, from 96 all the way to the year 2000. Even Eritrea, Isaias Afwerki was fully supporting the SPLM and the opposition that wanted to overthrow Bashir. And that kind of cooled down when it came to the deal with South Sudan and then leading up to the separation of South Sudan. But since Sisi came on board, Bashir was still keeping them at a distance, and Bashir was going more into the camp of the Gulf Arab countries. But since 2019, you're right in the sense where since 2019, the Egyptian military has had a chokehold on the entire Sudanese security sector. The RSF was the only thing that they didn't was able to coerce that much. But again, like, when you look at Egypt's relationship with the UAE, it's damn near the same country. You know, how much money the UAE's poured into Egypt and everything. But Egypt was able to coerce the security sector in Sudan. Like, Burhan was completely capitulated and coerced by Assisi and his intelligence. So it's almost like the colonial relationship coming back full swing in 2019.
Yeah, because for during colonial rule, Egypt was sort of de facto ruling Sudan,
Yes.
under the auspices of the United Kingdom, Britain, favoring
Yes.
Egypt. Well, and that we can get
And that's
that's another long
no,
conversation for.
but you're right, Moisa. Just very, very quickly, the diagnosis for Sudan SAF and why it's not successful and why it hasn't really fought any kind of war outside of Sudan and it's been squarely against Sudanese is because its makeup was a colonial makeup in the first place. You know, it was never designed to be a force that would, protect all of the regions of Sudan and like the borders and stuff like that. Even when it came to the RSF started first as the border guard. You know, after being just random Janjaweed, they made them the border guard to guard the border between, Sudan and Libya and Chad and everything. So you're right in that sense, where the makeup of SAF itself was more of a colonial makeup.
And then of course SAF birthed RSF, so that's the other thing.
Yes.
That's what we have to keep emphasizing, that this is not two separate forces. It's an internal fight between a force. But before we go, I wanted you to unpack what's happening on the ground for those who have really been doing the work. I mean, trying to stem the humanitarian crisis. So the grassroots organization, which have been, especially since 2019, really doing the work of what a government should do, providing the services. What are they doing? And expand. Oh, sorry, not what are they doing, but please spotlight more what they're doing, but also the ideas they have for future Sudans, because these are the people who are constantly not being brought to negotiating table. They particularly when the external forces get involved, they tend to try to remove the civilian, this part of the civilian population, which is the grassroots groups and the ones which are really, really, really supporting the people. Not so much the civilian population, which has very much connections with some of the military players,
Yes.
but the real civilian population leadership that's working on the ground day to day. If you could talk to us about the things that they're doing, but also how they see a future Sudan. What are some of their prescriptions for a future Sudan?
Yes. So, from the 2010s, like that period that we're talking about where Bashir kind of sold off the country, that the counteraction to that was a sense of kind of there was a huge boom in ground organizing and grassroots efforts. You started to see it in different there's the humanitarian, there was something called Emergency Street, for example, that was like a huge pool of volunteers who were helping people pay for their medical expenses. There was Nafir, that was a huge, these were all like 2013, 2014. Nafir was a huge campaign to help people that were affected by floods. Then you started getting a revival of the unions, like whether it's the labor unions, the professional associations, everything from journalists to doctors to lawyers have started reorganizing during those periods. So by the time it was 2019, it was like an atomic bomb of grassroots organizing and action. It's almost like anyone, like even there was a saying that, hey, if you want to support the December Revolution, get organized. You know, and we were kind of translating what Kwame Ture used to say, that, you know, the lessons that we got from the 60s was, you know, organize, organize, organize. And that's his message kind of to the youth. So that actually translated in 2019 to, you know, from the neighborhood level all the way to, like, you know, labor unions within ministries to, you know, even the private sector. You know, it was almost a renaissance in people organizing and mass movements. As the transitional period, like 2019, 2020, and 2021, then it started becoming kind of almost ingrained. You know, these youth would actually, you know, create resistance committees in the neighborhoods and, you know, service committees in the neighborhood to organize, you know, whether it's, you know, the fighting poverty and, you know, food distribution, and, you know, cooperatives started popping up left and right. So something was instilled within the Sudanese that was never going to leave completely. I argue sometimes that part, the goal of the war was to kind of break that grassroots organizing and militarize public life.
You've just been listening to a portion of a recent conversation with independent researcher and journalist Mosab Baba in Nairobi, focusing on the continuous humanitarian crisis and war in Sudan. The conversation explored and contextualized historic lack of accountability for warring parties in Sudan, the plight of children and women in the Sudan war, external and internal agents of war, and more. The full conversation will be available on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's at Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Fi Azil Alil by Abdel Karim Al Kabli. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muiza Montali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shah Anana Hussein Al-Amin, and that looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, and that's followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor. A little later on at 6 o'clock is the new show New World Order, which is followed by the Kombit Lakai at 7 o'clock with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers Kalia Chapman and Brian Burns III. And thanks to the entire team at the Africa World Now Project, a collective of Dr. Josh Myers, Kurt Erdison, Chanda Kozer, and Funangonda. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW. And thanks to you for joining us. I continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Aphrodisia by Dr. Lani Smith. And we play that remembering his birthday, which was July 3rd. Thank you. Have a great day, have a great week, and stay safe. Thank you.
from across the nation and around the world. For Pacifica Headlines, I'm Jesse Lent.
I think it's over. I don't want to deal with them anymore. They're scum. You know what scum is? They're scum. They're sick people. They're led by sick people. And they're vicious, violent people. And if they had a nuclear weapon, they'd use it. As far as I'm concerned, it's over. I'll speak to our negotiators. They want to negotiate. They're good people. Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner. But they have to come back to me. As far as I'm concerned, it's just a waste of time dealing with them. They're liars.
President Donald Trump appears to call off peace negotiations with Iran at the NATO summit in Turkey today. Footage and reporting courtesy of the BBC. U.S. officials said yesterday that military units had struck more than 80 Iranian targets in response to attacks on three oil tankers in the Strait of Hormuz earlier this week. Iranian officials have not directly claimed responsibility for striking the ships, but the country's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, announced that it was targeting U.S. military sites in Bahrain and Kuwait following the new round of U.S. bombing. NATO Chief Mark Rutte called the American strikes, quote, absolutely necessary in response to Iran's breach of the ceasefire. But Iranian Parliament Speaker and head negotiator Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf says it was the U.S. who violated the memorandum of understanding the two countries signed last month, citing U.S. attacks on Iran, renewed oil sanctions, threats of further strikes, violations of Iranian, quote, adjustments in the Strait of Hormuz, and continued Israeli attacks against Hezbollah in Lebanon in a post on X. Multiple attacks on the Iranian port city of Bandar Abbas overnight are heard in this BBC video, with several explosions visible and flames seen rising over a facility as the U.S. and Israel's war on Iran enters its 131st day. It was not immediately clear from the footage which sites the U.S. was targeting. Iran is currently in the fifth of 6 days of funeral services for their former supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, killed in the first day of the U.S. and Israel's war on Iran back on February 28th. Islamic tradition requires that the body of a deceased Muslim be buried as quickly as possible, ideally within 24 hours of passing, but Iranian officials had been waiting until an interim ceasefire was in effect with the U.S., presumably out of concern for the safety of millions of their citizens. Last night, Khamenei's body arrived in Najaf, Iraq. Local authorities declared today a public holiday, with procession ceremonies starting at 6 a.m. local time. President Trump is currently at the NATO summit in Ankara, Turkey. The president said he's only attending the summit this year because it is being hosted by his friend, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who welcomed Trump in person at the airport, according to the BBC. Trump announced today that he has ordered Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent to cut off all trade with Spain, calling the country a, quote, terrible partner in NATO. Back in March, Spain shot down a U.S. request to use joint military bases on its territory for operations against Iran. The country also closed its airspace to U.S. planes involved in the war. Speaking from NATO today, Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen responded to Trump's remarks earlier in the day that the U.S., quote, needs Greenland for, quote, the protection of the world, not just the United States, and it's very important. Footage courtesy of Agence France-Presse.
The U.S. position is unfortunately very clear on this topic, and our position is as clear as it has been all through. Greenland is, of course, not for sale. We are a sovereign state, and we need everybody to respect our territorial integrity.
And a backlash is growing, particularly in Democrat-led states, over National Guard deployments to Washington, D.C., after the Guard's numbers increased precipitously ahead of last week's celebration of the country's 250th anniversary of independence from Great Britain, according to the AP. Kaya Chatterjee, executive director of the organization Free D.C., told the news agency that D.C.'s residential neighborhoods are a red line for areas they will tolerate the Guard's presence.
If they want the federal district and the mall, they can have it. But they will never take our schools. They will never take our parks. They will never take our community. And so if they are going to come into our territory, then they are going to hear us.
Those are the latest Pacifica headlines for the Pacifica Network. I'm Jesse Lent.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that